Welcome to Next Us 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African-American community. I'm your host, Dr. JC. This episode series of Next Us 818 Podcast focuses on the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion, the only all-female African-American battalion to serve in the European Theater of Operations during World War II. If you're tuning into the podcast for the very first time, I encourage you to check out the inaugural episode from September the 7th of 2022 to learn about the background of the 6888. In episode 25, we interview a group of the 6888 advocates who recently journeyed to Scotland, England, and France to walk in the steps of this legendary unit. Welcome all. In episode 2, we recap the June 2023 Legacy Tour. In episode 24, we heard from 6888 descendants who were on this journey. And tonight, we have personal and in-depth conversation about the significance of the tour to some of the advocates who engaged the journey. So again, welcome all. And I'd like to start by asking each of you to introduce yourself and your connection with the 6888 Battalion. Edna, you want to start?
Yes, Colonel Retired Edna Cummings, and my connection with the 6888 started in 2018, so I consider myself a 6888 advocate and champion for the Congressional Gold Medal and some of the recognitions, and I was also the 6888 tour historian.
Okay, and to the audience, if you want to hear more about Colonel Cummings and her illustrious career and her involvement with the 6888, check out episode 20. Kaya?
Hello and good evening. I am Kaya Alderson. I am the author of the historical novel Sisters in Arms, which was inspired by the 6888 and the Black female officers from the World War II.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Check out episode 14 to learn more about Kaya. Crystal?
Hi, thanks so much. My name is Crystal Barnes. I am an independent content creator, and I am simply a fangirl of the 6888, and excited to be here and talk about more.
Thank you. So I'd like to start with a question. What compelled you to go on the tour? What did you hope to learn or understand? And anyone can go first.
So for myself, I was interested because I had started just learning about the 6888 probably a few months before, and I was doing some research online, and I came upon this podcast, and I want to say 9 or 10, and so I went back and listened to all the other podcasts, and there was some point where Dr. JC said something about a tour coming up, and I just did some research and I found it, and I was like, okay, I think I can do this. And so I was just excited to kind of join it. I had thought about writing a play about it. And so this would be really, really awesome research, because there's nothing to compete with actually being there.
Absolutely. Taya?
This tour was actually a godsend for me because I wrote the novel over the course of 10 years, but I didn't get the book deal until about 2018. And so I was finishing it up when the pandemic happened. So I did not get a chance to go to Europe to any of the sites before I finished the book. So, and I knew one of my big hindrances was, at that time I thought I'd have to go by myself, but since some of the places in France were off the beaten path and I don't speak a word of French, I was like, how am I going to do this? So when this tour came up, I was like, thank you. I can go specifically to these spots that I want to go to, just as, I guess, a fangirl of the 6888, as well as just, you know, my own personal ego to see how much I got right in terms of envisioning these places and how things work and where they were walking.
Well, I'm asking more about that in a minute. Yeah. Edna, what compels you to go on this journey, journey and lead the tour?
Yeah. Well, the passion for the 6888, as I mentioned, since 2018, I've just been so involved and engrossed in the story. And I was in the UK in 2019 with the 6888 documentary tour as guest of the US ambassador and the US embassy there. And so by walking some of those grounds already, I thought that I could help the descendants and advocates of the 6888 to really get that firsthand inside knowledge about what it was like in 1945. So just honored to have the opportunity to share some of my experiences and just give a different perspective about the 6888's time in Europe during World War II.
So for each, if everybody can jump in here. So fathers, highlights, and memories. I mean, we went to Glasgow, Birmingham, Stratford upon Avon, Bletchley Park, London, the Normandy area, Rouen, and Paris. So what are some of your fondest memories and highlights? And this will be very interactive here.
Well, I'll start. One of my fondest memories was Normandy, because after we went to Normandy and visited the graves of the three women who were buried there, I contacted Normandy American Cemetery, the American Battlefield Monuments, final resting place. When the women died, the army did pay for their funerals initially, but it was a basic funeral where they were wrapped in shrouds. And that was the army standard. Basically, they were wrapped in anything that was available: bed sheets, tablecloths, curtains, blankets, parachute canopies, discarded canvas, sh shelter halves from tent, from tents. So what Charity Adams did, she paid for an upgrade. That's what the army didn't pay for, because you had thousands and thousands of deaths during World War II. And so the army could not pay for the embalming and the traditional burials as we think of them today. So it was a battlefield burial. So that was the first thing I learned. So the perception is the army didn't pay for the burials. That's partially right. They didn't pay for the type of burial that the commander Charity Adams wanted, which was something a little bit more in line with what we are accustomed to in the US. And so these women were buried in uniforms and not in the traditional battlefield style. So that's the first thing I learned. The second thing I learned was that Normandy was the second place they were buried. And I did not know this until I had an interaction with the American Battlefield Monuments Commission. When the women died, they were originally buried at Saint Andre's Military Cemetery. And that's in France. And the bodies were moved in 1948 after the American Battlefield Monuments Commission contacted the families. So throughout Europe, you have American cemeteries, and some of the bodies stayed in American cemeteries. For example, there's an American cemetery in Cambridge. But Normandy is one of the largest, and it's the most recognized and most popular. So the women were moved to Normandy in 1948. So those are two, I guess, the top three things that I learned that I didn't know until I visited and was curious and contacted the Normandy to have that in-depth discussion about the women that were buried there.
Curious, and were they moved be for a specific reason, or do you know why? They were moved and not just, kept
Well,
there at the
because of
other
the
cemetery.
you have these, and I believe then Normandy is the largest. So why they were moved, I don't know that answer. But a lot of soldiers or a lot of troops were moved to Normandy, and we probably could look up the history of Normandy. I'm not sure when Normandy. I think it was 44, 45, and Normandy was actually, developed as a cemetery. But you think, battlefield conditions, sometimes the troops are buried in one location, the graves were marked temporarily, and later on they were moved to another cemetery. So those are the top three things that I learned. And Carmen, I'm sure you're going to cut some of this out because, a little rambling there. But yeah, so that I think that's important to know, that the army did pay for a basic burial, and Charity Adams paid it for. Charity Adams paid for an upgrade, for lack of a better term, with caskets and embalming, and so the women could be buried in their uniform. Yeah, Saint Andre Military Cemetery.
It's right on the border of Belgium and France.
Okay. So what were your fondest memories?
My fondest memories, I really don't have I mean, it was all so great. I cannot pick out one. I honestly cannot think of one that I enjoyed over the other. Just the experience itself. When we started in Scotland on the pre-tour, I didn't spend much time in Scotland when I was there before. So touring around Scotland, and because every place else I pretty much been to. So Scotland, that was new to see. And I know that community event to watch executions. I never thought it in terms of a community event, not that it had anything to do with the 6888 tour, but just the opportunity to see some of that history was fascinating. So,
Okay.
Scotland, I believe. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
The two places that stand out for me the most was Birmingham and Normandy. And Birmingham was just because I flew in a couple days early, went to London. It was busy. And I liked that Birmingham is a big city, but it's not as busy. It's calm. I felt we were starting to make more connections with the community there since we were invited to all of the Windrush activities and got to learn a little bit about that. And in terms of when I was writing the book, in my head, I spent a lot of time in Birmingham. And it was really cool as we're driving down the street towards the school. I was sitting bouncing in my seat because I was like, this is exactly how I pictured it in my head. This is it exactly. So that was really cool just to have that surreal experience. Normandy is somewhere where I could actually see, if I spoke enough French, I would want to live there or just chill out there because it's just so peaceful and quiet. And, given the historical magnitude for us as Americans, you'd think it was a place that was sad, but it was just really, I could see where that would be a vacation destination, if you will, had World War II not happened. I also had a moment on Utah Beach that isn't 6888 related when I saw the boats that those guys were on when they were being transported from the boats to the beaches, and just to see how exposed they were and how basically they were sitting ducks. I'm not necessarily that person that, watch, I've only seen like Saving Private Ryan once or twice or those type of movies, but something about that, just the space of it just got to me and I kind of lost it, and it was just a meaningful moment.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I concur with both Etna and Kaya. Normandy was probably my fondest memory, mostly because, honestly, because of the ceremony that we had for the women, and honestly seeing the descent of lost track of research, but really started to observe what was going on emotionally for the descendants, for them being there, especially during the ceremony, and for their emotional connection to their relatives, the women that served for them. And then some of the conversations I had later to talk about how people were, feeling. People were really emotional during that time. So for me, I think it was just that observation of the of descendants for me. I did also like, I'm going to mess up the name, Rouen,
Ruan, yes.
and the idea that they're renaming one of their streets to Ch Charity Adams. Is it Charity Adams Avenue? I don't know for sure. But their ceremony, even with some let's just say confusions about some of the songs that they sang or had played, but I really I guess I appreciated that there was a they at least had some rec wanted to recognize these the 6888 women, specifically Charity
And
Adams.
Crystal, you triggered a memory. I am now excited about the recreations that we did, the one in Strathbond-Avon, to actually stand exactly where members of the 6888 stood. So touching Shakespeare's statue was pretty phenomenal, now that I think about it. And I do have an alibi in military terms regarding Normandy, if I may. Looking at my notes from the American Battlefield Monuments Commission, it says that during World War II, over 400,000 Americans were killed. The collection, identification, and burial of the dead was the responsibility of Graves Registration Service. While by July 90, 1945, the war had ended, but following the war, the dead were concentrated into a smaller number of concentrated cemeteries. Following the war, the dead were concentrated in a smaller number of cemeteries while the War Department went about identifying the next of kin. And so the War Department then offered the next of kin the option of bringing the bodies home or remaining them overseas. So the attempt was to concentrate as many of the dead as possible, over 400,000 Americans. So hopefully that gives some additional information about the movement of the three women from the St. Andre Cemetery to the cemetery in Normandy.
It's interesting to me that if the families had the option of bringing the bodies home, that they didn't exercise that option. So that's just an interesting footnote. So a little early, I asked you what compelled you to go on the tour and what you learned. You were seeking something. I mean, I think whenever we engage in any journey, we seek something. So what did you learn, or understand better, or appreciate more? Anything stand out? Hey, let's start with you, because you alluded to that.
I appreciated how our journey kind of mirrored the experiences of the women as we went to each location. Luckily, our three people that got separated from us in Rouen came back to us in one piece. But it just kind of, where you had questions, you know, as I was developing my story about how people interacted with each other and how they were tight-knit in Birmingham, but then kind of, people kind of started to scatter once they hit France. Like, I got a better understanding of that. It made me feel better about the fact that when I wrote my book, I wrote it, even though I didn't consult with any of the families in that process, but I wrote it with the sense of, if anybody ever wrote it with read it, that I did it with care and respect for their memories. And then to see that play out, and when we were in specific spaces where people were having emotional reactions to it, it was kind of surreal, because it's like, I felt it, but it didn't touch me in the way that others did. And it occurred to me, like, oh, wait, some of these family members, you know, they had only recently lost their mothers within the last couple of years. And I think it was an honor to be a part of that healing. I think that was happening for a lot of people in terms of where they were in their grief walk, or of losing their mothers or aunts or whoever that person was special to them. So, and just to be able to hold, you know, because I was disconnected enough to hold that space. So it was just learn, you know, it was just moving.
two comments I want to make. Mm-hmm. My family, the four of us went, and we talked about this, and it's like, we didn't feel a sense of grief at all. I mean, because of the because of the way my mother had portrayed her experience, we felt as though we were following. She described it as an adventure. We felt like we were following her adventure, and so that we could understand her better as a young person, as opposed to the one who's always trying to tell people what to do and make us all into perfect children or grandchildren. And so that's how we kind of approach it, like the adventure, tried to do the wide-eyed view that she might have taken as a young 20-something going to Europe. But I do want to comment about your book. I was thinking about this earlier. Grace, okay? Grace was the author's daughter, the publisher's daughter in your book.
Oh, that was
Eliza. Yeah. You know, that show, when I was reading that and the Vestine Murphy story, boy, it sure did attract very, very nicely. Since you did the interview with the family, it tracked very nicely to the history of the Afro newspaper. And by the way, for the audience, in the September 20th broadcast, we'll be interviewing the son of Vestine Murphy. So, by the way. But anyway.
Yeah, because I knew of the family, but I didn't necessarily even dig into the whole dynamics of it, or how deep they were connected to the 6888 story. And so once I went back in hearing Roger talk about this, I was like, oh, wow, I pretty much got it. That's
you,
cool.
You did. And
what was the question again?
You were seeking something on this tour. What actually did you learn or understand, appreciate better as a consequence of
Did you have an aha kind of moment? Did you understand anything any better as a consequence of engaging this journey with the descendant?
Well, I think my moment was sharing a lot of information with the families because I'd done so much research over the past years, and it was type of the sharing was more sporadic, individuals. And when I write articles or conduct interviews, that's how a lot of families receive, I guess, the additional information. But to see the appreciation and the connection that the families had and the advocates had with the story when we were in Rouen, standing exactly where the 6888 worked and knowing that they lived upstairs. And I go back to recreating some of those iconic images. And even in Rouen, there was one image of is that the National Archives photo has of Private Ruth James standing in front of the doorway. I mean, these women were such a novelty in France. And Janice Martin stood in a similar look. So just bringing the women back in a sense by standing where they stood, touching the actual objects and places that they experienced. And then again, the welcome that we had by the locals. We had dinner in Scotland with the university professor Timothy Peacock from Glasgow. In Birmingham, we tales who didn't know anything about the 6888 to see how the concierge just says, "Oh my God, please walk anywhere you want to. This is, you know, where these women were." We didn't know the story. So it was about sharing information with the family members and watching the expressions of the locals who had maybe never heard of the 6888 or those who had heard of the 6888 and then were excited that we were there. As an example, the article that Oprah Flash wrote for the BBC about these women being erased from history. I mean, that's a very great article, and it was translated into three languages. So that's part of the joy that I have to know that I was part of the journey, literally and physically, to retrace those steps. And then educating the public, because I think this, for me, it's a public education campaign to bring these women out of obscurity into the forefront. And the tour, the families, and everything involved in sharing this story is shaping history. Because now people are talking about history. And now in World War II books and articles, the 6888 is included. Because before, I never recall seeing anything about Black women from World War II, maybe a casual mention about a nurse, but nothing about Black women in World War II. And I cannot think of any movie or documentary that really talked about the 6888 until now. So the 6888 is, I think, again, with the families and everyone, we helped to shape history.
I
So
wonder.
that was
Go ahead, Crystal.
I was just gonna say, my objective was a little bit, it's almost the opposite of Kaya's because she had already written her book and she wanted to make sure that she got it right. I was going to prepare to write a play and I wanted to make sure I didn't get it wrong. So that was for me the, I would say the main objective was to go get research, be in the actual places where these women were, and we have the internet, but there's nothing like actually being there and touching and talking to the people and understanding the culture, even though it's 70 years away, still there's the culture that you can't quite get when you're on the internet. So, and part of, and also just as with Kaya, I saw her book in the library, and I think I started reading the first 10 pages. And then I said, I don't want to be influenced by this or anyway, because I'm writing my own thing. So I haven't still read Kaya's book. I will do it as soon as
Great book.
I will finish, everything that I'm writing. I think it was just, learning where a few people, was it Helen? Is that her name?
Helen
The young
Murdoch.
lady who dressed. There are a few people who are enthusiasts and didn't know about At least the wax and a little bit about the 6888, that, you know, it wasn't totally, like, though it's not known as other, you know, bits about World War II, there are still a few people who are enthusiastic about the 6888. And so I was excited about that. And I was excited that we were there, and hopefully there would be many, many more tours with the 6888 that people can then begin to learn more about these women.
So that's a good opportunity for Edna to comment on some of the thoughts for the 2025 tour.
Yeah. Well, the 2025 tour, fingers crossed that will happen. Hopefully the 6888 musical will be in production. And talking with those producers, we would like to have the 6888 musical tour. It's not finalized, not set in stone, but that would be great to have, you know, 6888 musical groupies, because that's part of retracing the steps. So hopefully that will happen. And next time, what I would like, what we didn't have time to do, I would really like for the tour attendees to visit this area called the Sutton Coalfield, because Europe had been at war since 1939, and the U.S. troops had not come over until 1942. So the mail services started in 1942. And when you read online, you read some of these stories, no one ever talks about that postal network, to put the 6888's work in context. Because speaking with Fran and Fran Collins, and the authors of this book, Letters for Victory, Fran and Martha Collins, they talk about that postal network and how war-torn London and the surrounding areas was, that whole area. And the European Theater of Operations was the hub of postal activity for the entire European Theater of Operations. So not only did you have the U.S. forces, you had, you know, the Allies in the surrounding areas. Everybody was getting mail. So every country had their own postal network. So I think I would like to be able to share a little bit more about the postal network that the 6888 was a part of, and what it was like from 42 until the 6888 got there in 1945. Because with that information, I think we could understand the magnitude, because other units had tried and failed to clear that mail backlog. You had 1942 when the US got involved in the war. Then you had D-Day 1944, but before 1944, you had preparations for D-Day. Then you had the aftermath of D-Day. So that is something that I just would like to spend more time on, and if we have time, in 2025 for the 6888. I'm going to put it out there, the 6888 musical tour, and hopefully it will happen. But if not, I think we will have enough in Europe and France to kind of do what we did, you know, with this last tour.
And I hope that we get to spend this go around a little bit more time in Scotland. That's 2 years off, though.
Yeah. And London. I mean, I spent a lot of time in London.
That's true.
As well. So London would be great.
For the audience, I did want to comment. Edna had made reference to the iconic images that we recreated. So check out the Afro newspaper online, and for the July 13th, 2023 special edition, an article entitled "Descendants of the 6888 Retrace the Steps of Their Ancestors." So that contains some nice images. So how do you plan to use this newfound the newfound discoveries to spread the word about hidden figures such as 6888? They're not the only group. There are many other hidden figures in our community. And so how has this experience pushed you to help tell those stories, find and tell those stories? And you, in each of you operates in a different sphere of influence, different occupations. Have you given any thought to that? Did you say, you know, when I go back, I'm going to, or this is how we can. And it's mainly about making, to me, it's always about making the young people aware. I'm always talking to young people about I still wear the wristband. And so people ask me about it. And I'd love the opportunity to talk to young people, the Gen Zs. And so that, to me, is kind of where I want to focus on that group. Although Lord knows we have a lot of baby boomers, Gen Xs, and millennials who still don't know, but I like the Gen Zs. Hopefully they can fix some of these things baby boomers are broken. But go ahead. Anyone, any thoughts on that?
I can jump on that one. Even before the tour, when I've been doing my public speaking or just talking to people one-on-one, I always say, you know, my hidden agenda is to get you to talk to your family members, either about what you've done that you don't think is that impressive and put it in context of history, or ask your elders while they're still here about what they were doing, even if it just seems mundane things. The two people who came back to me from one speaking engagement, this one girl, she went and told her mother about my presentation and what I was saying. And she found out in that conversation, her family had come from Mississippi. And I think her understanding was that she'd come from a long line of sharecroppers, only to find out, no, her family was very active in the civil rights movement in the 60s and 50s down there, and playing significant roles on the boots on the ground type things. And she's like, oh, wait, we were, you know. And so she had that moment, that aha moment. And another was a friend of mine. She was like, I think my grandfather, you know, my uncle knew Martin Luther King. And she just gave me a name and two facts. And just in digging, come to find out, not only did her uncle know Martin Luther King, they went to Morehouse together. And I think they might have even been line brothers together when they pledged. And she was like, oh, I was like, no, that's his boy. That's not just, oh, you know, he was like the head of the NAACP where they were. It's like, no, wasn't that they were okay, you know. And so she's like, I come from people who, I'll keep doing that, even with my next books and the ideas and the situations and people I want to talk about, even in my own story where I was able to my own family dig back and find a potential family member that was according to the records that she was born in Charleston in 1766. And it's like, oh, so instead of people telling you, oh, go, if you don't like it here, go back where you came from, it's like, oh, my people been here for a while. We've been, and we contributed to even the founding of this country. So I'll just keep flapping my mouth so people will talk to people, their family members, and find out their stories.
Yeah, that's important. People so often live in the present that they don't really think, yeah, you know, they just maybe know one generation, but they don't really go back to try to roll back several generations. Crystal?
Yeah, I think I work, you know, around a lot of young people. Part of my job is to help folks find work on television sets and film sets and that sort of thing, although with the strikes we're on hiatus. But I also, you know, create things. And I think I've talked to Edna about this, and I know that there's a film coming out about 6AAA with Tyler Perry. I know that about the musical, and I have the play, and there've been books, and I don't mind that there, you know, this over, it's not even oversaturated, but hopefully more saturated, because we get to see, or I see or hear about the Holocaust or a story about the Holocaust every year, I mean, via so many different mediums. And so there's nothing wrong with having, you know, different projects and about the 6AAA. And I think that's part of how people learn. Some people will find it in a book. Some people will find it in a play. Someone will see it in a movie or whatever. And if you start to see it more, people start to understand that this really did exist. And so that's part of what I'm, you know, doing, just not only talking to people one-on-one, but also creating, you know, stories that will hopefully live beyond me and will continue on.
Edwin?
Yeah, and for me, I agree with Kaye, the storytelling. I also encourage people to talk to their family members, because number one, veterans really don't talk about their military service, and there's so much information that's not talked about, and not only with veterans, but just people in general. A lot of them do not talk about those experiences that have helped our nation. That's the first thing. And Chris, I agree with you 200%. I mean, there are scores upon scores, thousands of stories about World War II. There is nothing wrong with having multiple ways of storytelling about the 6AAA or any other. And then thirdly, I want to mention the Society for Black Military Studies. I'm working with a group of people. We are forming a Society for Black Military Studies. We should have a website up soon where it's open for everyone who has an interest in Black military studies and history to join. So to enrich the network, to know that there are stories out there that have not been told, and so many hidden figures within the military and beyond that are out there. So we're looking for opportunities for people to have a platform, and instead of the accomplishments of one of or two military units from certain engagements, there's room for several heroes, several stories, because anyone who has worn the uniform did it for a purpose and contributed. And sometimes those contributions are not highlighted. So this is an opportunity for people to highlight those stories, and it may inspire someone. I'm not on a big recruiting campaign for people to join the military. But yeah, it's a part of our history, the Black military studies. You just don't hear a lot about. You hear one or two of those names, and part of my goal with starting the recognition or contributing to the recognitions for the 6888, I wanted the 6888 to be in the same sentence as other Black units who served. And you think World War II, the first unit comes to mind, Tuskegee Airmen. But now we know about the Montfaucon Marines, the Navajo Code Talkers, and other units of color who did not receive the recognition. But however, with the 6888, the 6888 is the only military women's unit to receive the nation's highest honor, and that's the Congressional Gold Medal. And that says a lot because of the thousands and thousands of pieces of legislation that go before Congress every year. Probably 3% may pass. So to get the president to sign two pieces of legislation honoring the 6888, the first being the Congressional Gold Medal, and the second is the renaming of the post office in Buffalo, New York, after Ms. Indiana Hunt Martin. And what's interesting about Ms. Hunt Martin's story, she worked in a facility that was part of the Manhattan Project. And so now with all of these stories coming about the 6888 and their lives before the war and the lives after the war, sometimes the contributions after the war were just as significant. And I use the 6888 as an example, but there are a lot of stories out there just about people in general. And my area is Black military studies, but beyond the military.
So, thank you. Any of you identified another hidden figures group that you think we need to kind of bring to the fore? Anybody, any one or two groups stand out? Because I'm gonna try to get some of their descendants on the podcast too. So as soon as you identify them, I'm gonna start looking at to the audience. I'm gonna be interviewing descendants of the Montfaucon Marines coming up this fall. But
And
I'm sure there are other groups.
yeah, there are other groups because the 6888, first of all,
Or individuals.
was only a slice of the African American women who served during World War II. So you had women who served in the US, women of color who were serving in the US. And one story sticks out to mind that's a book by Alexis Clark, who wrote about the German POW and the Black nurse
Oh yeah,
fell in
I just heard
love.
about that. Yeah.
Yeah, enemies in love. So that's one story. But you have stories post-World War II, Sarah Keays, who sat in the back of, who didn't sit where she was supposed to on a bus. And Sarah Keays was post-World War II. A Congressional Gold Medal was introduced for her. But these Black women post-World War II made significant contributions and impact for civil rights. And those stories aren't told. So from a military perspective and a woman of color who served in the military, I think there are a lot of stories post-World War II, probably even from World War II to Vietnam, Korean War, that have not been told. They're just out there. And they haven't been told, number one, because no one has approached these individuals or their families to tell the stories. And number two, the response that we received from a lot of 6888 members, what's the big deal? We were just soldiers doing our jobs. So with that mindset, there's a lot of modesty
Right.
and a lot of hidden stories that are out there. It just takes, someone to bring those stories to the forefront.
Okay.
In terms of military, I think the week after I turned in my book, I found out my grandfather's oldest sister was actually an officer in the WAC. I think she came out. She was not in the first officer class, but she I think she was like early no February no 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 February 43. So she was fairly early on. And she retired when she left the military. She wound up in Cleveland, was one of the first Black female reporters with the major newspaper. She was on their transit committee, things like that. And she actually lived until I was in my teens and I never met her. And only now finding out about her contribution. She's like in the Case Western Hall of Fame, University Hall of Fame. There was one of the early officers. She was stationed down in Arizona, and I think she was the first Black woman to command white troops in the war. I forget her name, but she died because she had appendicitis or her spleen burst or something. But she was down in like Bisbee or Fort Huachuca area. My next book is about Effa Manley, who is currently the only woman in the Baseball Hall of Fame. It's not military, but most people don't. I didn't even realize while I was writing her story that she was in the Hall of Fame and she was the only woman. And she was a general manager for the Negro Leagues team in the 30s and 40s, where usually we hear, women were at home doing, housewives, and she was actually, running things, telling off these Black men who were running Black baseball and white men who are running white baseball. So she's very fascinating. And then the other ones I'm not going to talk about because I want to write the book and I haven't gotten the deal yet.
It'll be a surprise for us. Crystal?
I mean, I'm interested in women even before World War II. There have been significant women of color who contributed quite a bit. There's a woman who was a spy in the Civil War, who was a, a formal slave and, went to France and came back, and her old slave owner kind of brought her in at as a spy. And I mean, women of color have been instrumental to the world from day one. So there's a so many stories to be written that we could, we wouldn't there wouldn't be enough time to write about the story. So I'm all for that. I'm all for just writing specific stories about women, period, because there just aren't enough of our stories out there. People for some reason think because the stories aren't told that we have not contributed anything and we're not significant. And I think that's part of why I don't know. I think there's some things that we could learn from that, and it would help. So I'm with I believe the stories should get made, and I'm doing everything I can to do that, and work also working with different folks to do it as well.
Yeah, we need to use every possible medium we can to share these stories. And as I said before, as you identify interesting historical figures and as you meet any of their families, let me know because I'd love to get them on. I don't want to preempt any of your creative writing projects that you, Crystal and Kaya have, but this is just another medium to share the information. So as we move to wrap up, any closing reflections or words of wisdom to my listeners?
Yeah, I think storytelling is a way to get people interested in history because in the academic environment, history is, unless you're just really passionate about it, it's one of those boring classes. You learn enough to pass a test. I know I get a lot of questions. Why wasn't 6888 taught in schools? Well, first of all, it's a niche area. It's military history. Nobody teaches military history. You learn about the big guys, maybe Patton, Eisenhower, and the context of the war itself. So military history is a unique topic within itself. And there's not a true connection in terms of military history from people of color and the impact on civil rights. We just commemorated Truman's 75th anniversary of the desegregation of the armed forces. He also desegregated the federal workplace. And because of World War II, we had a group of African Americans and people of color who had an opportunity for education through GI Bill. There's a lot of discussion now about how African Americans were denied access. Yes, to an extent, a lot of them were, but a lot of them being African Americans, a lot of that demographic did use the GI Bill. Most women in the 6888 use the GI Bill. Not only to get an education, but to buy homes.
Yes, my mother did both, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of bothers me sometimes when you just lump an entire community into a narrative and you don't tell the rest of the story. So by understanding history and by telling these stories in different formats, you know, the flat text, whether it's online or in a history book, that's one way to share a story. But we can see with the Broadway musical Hamilton how that caused people to dig deeper. And that is something that I believe if you tell the story the right way, it will cause people to dig deeper. And so hopefully, you know, with the 6888 as an example, with the way the story is being told, Crystal, through your project, with the Netflix movie, with the musical, or just by seeing the family members, there has been a natural curiosity. And I think that's why this story is now at the forefront, because no one knew, and all these family members are literally just showing up. So the rich history of the military and their impact on our society, I think by sharing these stories, we can better connect the two, because a lot of the troops and members of the military were drafted, you know, back in World War II up until post-Vietnam, so it was mandatory service. But Admiral Michelle Howard says something that was powerful that I heard her say: women have always volunteered. So you have thousands and thousands of women of color who've always stepped up to serve their nation. They weren't volunteers. Then on top of that, during World War II, all the women had to have high school diplomas and the men did not. And so when the 6888 was selected, 855 women represented about 13% of the African American women in, during World War II. 85% were ex-school teachers or had college degrees. So they were above the national standards for literacy, period, because post-Depression literacy levels in World War II were extremely low. And a lot of the recruits, you know, low literacy levels. So the 6888 were some of the best and brightest in the nation. The women who served were some of the best and brightest in the nation. And the standards were not lowered. The women had to be better, and women of color had to be better, better, better. So that's just an example of really digging to the history of, and I'll keep it in context of the military, how it's so rich and how that training and those experiences and those educational opportunities gave a demographic the skills and talent and a voice to make a difference in their communities. And so many times we hear about the impact within a community with and ignore the military service. So I'd like to see a better bridging of those two narratives. It's not either or, it's a combined narrative.
One thing I also want to just hit home on is that history is, those stories are not final and they're still being written. And even the little bit that you think you know that isn't that important adds to the story. We had so many moments on the tour where the experts were talking and we were able to chime in and say, add a little bit, hey, look at it this way. Did you notice this, these characteristics about this person? Or as we're talking, I'm sitting here Googling, oh wait, the person you were talking about is actually buried in the cemetery we just left and we didn't, you know, and the expert didn't know. Or when they were saying we didn't, you know, we know that Black troops were on Normandy so many days after D-Day, but we don't know what they're doing. And I was able to say my grandparents' next door neighbor was there, and this is what he was doing to confirm the what we think but can't prove is like, well, here's a, you know, this is what they're, you know, I was able to say, no, this is what's happening. So just know that everybody can contribute. It adds more seasoning, more flavor to the story, and it makes it more inclusive on a personal level. And it isn't even about, you know, the catchphrases of DEI and diversity. It makes it personal to you, whatever you look like or whatever your background is for. And it makes you, it helps you to appreciate and have more pride even that you didn't, you know, you might have already had pride in your country or your community or whatever, and just be like, oh, wait, I'm a part of that too.
Crystal, any closing reflections or words of wisdom to the podcast audience?
I mean, I think, you know, Kaya and Anna said really well. I think, you know, the same. There are women who've contributed a great deal throughout history, and stories have not been told. And I want to be one of those people that contribute to tell those stories.
Well, I want to thank you all, each of you, for joining me tonight and sharing your tour experiences and reflections. I'm very grateful. Edna, Kaia, Crystal.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Good to see you guys again.
To my audience, thank you for listening to Next Us 818 podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Tonight, I will share a quote from Fabiosa Daly about freedom. Freedom begins when you stop trying to fit yourself into someone else's frame. See you for our next show on September 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Google Podcasts, New York City Podcast Network, and Spotify for Podcasters.